My name is Alana Bruton. I will be interviewing Marge Reardon, a hospital-trained nurse, for the exhibit, A Few Good Women, World War II Women Veterans, for the Women's Historical Museum. Why did you decide to enlist?
When I was a child of about, I don't know, somewhere maybe 10, and I lived in a rural community, and I remember reading a story in a magazine about World War I nurse overseas. And I always said from there on that I wanted to be a nurse. And if there was ever a war, I wanted to be an Army nurse. So this was the beginning of my goal. Mm-hmm. And there was never any doubt when World War II came along. But with graduating in 1943, that I would join the service.
Why did you decide to go overseas?
Well, we were 21, 22, and there was always on a bulletin board a place to sign up for overseas duty. Mm-hmm. And my roommates and I routinely did this. I remember signing many times, wanting to go overseas, mm-hmm. because I wanted to see the world. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just curious. And felt, as I've read some of my old letters, and when I told my folks that I was going in the service, I didn't have any brothers. And I felt that this was the least that I could do, was to volunteer to go in the service. The sister was a school teacher, and there was no opportunity there. And mm-hmm. I was a nurse, and nurses were badly needed. Mm-hmm. So,
how did your family and the community respond?
I never knew until very recently that my family, my parents, were really upset when they got that letter that I sent to them. And my sister told me that. She said, oh, they were very upset. Now, I was close to an aunt and uncle out at Okemos, and I guess they were equally as upset. Mm-hmm. But from, 22-year-old, why? that kind of says it. And we were in a war, and I think it was the spirit of the times. We all wanted to help. Mm-hmm. We all wanted to help. And I had a skill, and so this was a... nurses were badly needed. Let me show you. What if I got this? This is a typical thing that you would see.
It looks very glorious.
Of course it looks very glorious. Uh-huh, uh-huh. And as youth, with being a nurse, you really didn't think about the dangers. Mm-hmm. You thought about a duty that you had to your country and to your fellow man. That's where I came from.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were trained
at Sparrow.
At Sparrow. So mm-hmm. you were already trained as a nurse.
Yes.
But what was the training like?
It was a 3-year program.
Okay.
I went in 1940 and graduated in 43. It was an excellent training program, mm-hmm. Much, much hands-on, mm-hmm. much, much responsibility. It wasn't a lot, you had a lot of book learning, and we were very disciplined, in other words, I would have to say even very controlled, because we lived in a nurse's home, mm-hmm. and we kept hours, and we had certain study hours, and we had, and that was interspersed with spending time in the hospital, on the ward, mm-hmm. taking care of patients. And of course, when you first start out, that's a very gradual process. And as you got in your second year, you were given more responsibilities and likely work shifts with supervisor over the entire hospital if you were on afternoons or midnights. Mm-hmm. And the same thing in the third year, you were. We spent 3 months down at Herman Kiefer Hospital on the tuberculosis and the contagious wards. So, and that was what you called an affiliation. Always, I would say that when I look back on it, the training that we received was very outstanding. Mm-hmm. Very outstanding. Prepared me for my experience in the military, because we didn't, other than taking, as we went into the military, then I can tell you in a few minutes about what type of stateside experiences we had. Mm-hmm. Working.
Well, what was the military training like?
Well, we spent 3 weeks at Camp McCoy, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. That was our first duty station. And it was more just, we didn't get any hospital training at that point in time. After all, we were graduate nurses. We were registered nurses. Mm-hmm. But we got training in how to march, how to salute, how to do this, that, and the other thing. Go through the gas chamber. We had to put a gas mask on and then go through this gas chamber. And that type of experience. And we were there 3 weeks.
Was that specific to overseas training, or now was everyone?
Everybody. Okay. At that point in time. Now, this was in 43.
Okay.
And I have, no, 44. And I have read later that when nurses were first inducted into the military, and they, likely a lot of them went in 41 and 42 and 43, a lot of those never went to basic training. They went directly, they put them directly to work in a hospital situation. So they did not have the military background at that point in time. They may have picked it up later.
Because they were so immediately
they
needed.
They were needed so immediately.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, were your officers male, female, your head officers in training?
In training. You mean now you're talking about in the Sparrow Hospital?
Mm-mm. In military training.
In military training. No, they were all men.
How was that like?
I guess we never thought anything about it.
So you were treated very well?
I was treated very well.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. I don't recall any females. Never thought about that. Well, see, this was 44.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, 44. And, of course, as you worked in hospitals, then there were officers that were over you, that there were some females there.
Mm-hmm.
But even as I think about my experience overseas initially, some nurses were trained as anesthetists. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what their rank was, I really don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And keep in mind that with a small organization like I was connected with, our main officer was a major, and he was an MD, and then we had a captain who was also an MD. Mm-hmm. And those were the only two that we had for our small unit. There were a lot of, and I'm going to kind of move from one, digress from one visible thing to another. Like in a general hospital where we spent some time initially when we went overseas, there were, I don't recall any female doctors. It was only male doctors.
Mm-hmm.
I do recall female nurses who were superior to me. And like the nurse over this hospital, this large hospital. I'm sure that she was a captain or a major. Mm-hmm. So doctoring was for doctors, for male doctors, and the female people were the nurses. Because there were no male nurses at that point in time. Mm-hmm. No male nurses.
Well, this kind of gets into stereotypes. Did you feel that there were some stereotypes about being a military woman?
A military
Yeah.
A service woman?
Mm-hmm.
I never felt it. Mm-hmm. I absolutely never felt it. I couldn't have asked to be treated nicer. I always felt like I was treated like an angel. Now maybe some people did, but I never felt it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was wondering what, when you went overseas, how did you get acquired with doing the train hospitals? How did you fall into that?
Okay. That happened when we left Fort Custer.
Okay.
We'd been at Fort Custer for 3 months, working in the station hospital. And our orders then, that was where we were all signing up for overseas duty. Then we got orders to go to Camp Ellis, Illinois, to join the 26th Hospital Train Unit. And that is where we first were assigned to a hospital train. And we spent some time there getting oriented to life on a hospital train because they had a real model of a hospital train.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't, at Camp Ellis, we were there for 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And completed the requirements for preparing for overseas duty.
Mm-hmm.
We got leaves were given, immunizations completed, and physical requirements met.
Okay.
That's where you filled out your will and all this good stuff. Viewing propaganda films, practical training included loading and unloading battle casualties
mm-hmm.
under blackout conditions. And this is, as I show you a picture of a hospital train, why, then this will, you'll be able to understand what I mean, the windows and so on. And we did, as we were overseas, we functioned under blackout conditions, of course. Hmm. So, okay. We left Camp Ellis on the 4th of June of 44.
Okay.
And we went from there to Camp Miles Standish near Boston, our port of embarkation. And then on the 21st of June of 44, we boarded the British ship Aquitania for the trip to England.
What was that like?
Well, the band played over there, and I will never forget that because it really brought it home to you. Mm-hmm. Here you are, you know, you're in your, I guess we were wearing our dress uniforms with our overcoats and our helmets and we were carrying our stuff on our back. We're marching up the gangplank, and this is when they played over there. It was an experience, I think, how many were there of us? Okay. Oh, there were 10,000 troops on board.
Wow.
And the ship was unescorted. And it zigzagged to avoid enemy detection on the 7-day trip. Since this was a British vessel, food was a challenge. 2 meals a day. You want to hear the rest?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Kidney stew for breakfast. And if you're hungry, you can eat it. If you get seasick, eat apples. And a lot of our people got seasick. Fortunately, I didn't.
Uh-huh.
Now, this was, see, in June, the land of the midnight, the time changes. You remember how long days are?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we wouldn't have sunset until 10, 11 o'clock at night. We played an awful lot of cards. We, you know, with that many people, of course, I think there were only... When I mentioned the 10,000 troops, now, a lot of those were enlisted personnel, and they were in the lower areas of the ship. There were quite a number of male officers, and then I think there were under 100 female nurses on that ship. The nurses always ate last. And that's where I really had to make up my mind that with having only two meals a day, that kidney stew didn't appeal very much. It's a British ship,
mm-hmm.
and it's a very common dish for the British people. But if you're hungry, you can eat it.
Why did nurses eat last?
I don't know. Maybe they thought that the room that we were in on the ship, there were 15 people in the room. We were three tiers. You could use facilities on the ship just at certain times of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that number of people on that ship. And perhaps the reason the nurses ate last was they figured that, I don't know. I really hadn't thought about that.
What was your daily routine once you were on the hospital train?
Okay.
What was that like?
Just made the daily routine. We got to our hospital train. We received orders the 12th of September of 44 that our personnel, and there were two doctors and one other administrative individual, 39 enlisted men and 6 nurses. And we were sent to Bournemouth, England, where we were going to be assigned to hospital train number 21.
Mm-hmm.
And this was built by the British. And at that time, the United States Medical Service had only 5 hospital trains on the continent in September 18th of 1944. And the problem was the availability of transportation across the channel. Now, we loaded onto a ferry September 23rd of 44. And that could accommodate railroad cars.
Mm-hmm.
We went from Southampton to Cherbourg, France, and then proceeded to Paris. Now, our routine on the train, keep in mind that we lived on that train. We ate on that train. Everything. That was our home.
Mm-hmm.
And as we didn't have any patients at that point in time. We went from Cherbourg, France to Paris. Now, if supply trains had to use that railroad, we would have to wait because we had no assignment at that point in time. The supply trains got priority,
mm-hmm.
or the mail or the troop trains that were headed to further up beyond Paris, they got priority at that time. Hospital train didn't. We saw a lot of destruction from St. Lo and at Cannes. and a lot as we went along the, as we went through the Normandy Peninsula, because so many, the beaches of where our men had gone in were in the Normandy Peninsula. And that's where you have heard about Utah and Omaha and Pointe du Hoc and so on. Mm-hmm. And that trip from Cherbourg to Paris took 5 days. So, you know, we were sidetracked a lot. And Paris was headquarters for our organization for the duration. And all the orders for the train came through an organization there in Paris. The trains were assigned to any one of three train stations. Gare Saint-Lazare, Gare de l'Est, or Gare du Nord. And it's interesting, I have written down here that there was no noticeable damage to Paris. And this great city had been spared from destruction. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing traveling from Cherbourg to Paris and seeing all that destruction. And then getting in Paris and there's very limited destruction.
Were you scared? I mean, during the whole zigzagging of the boats and seeing all this destruction?
I don't, at that point in time, I don't recall ever being frightened. It was later, one incident, and I remember being afraid at that point in time, but that was much later. But curiosity more than anything, perhaps. And see, at that point in time, we had not transported any patients. Mm-hmm. So, I really had never given it any thought. Mm-hmm. I think perhaps you could describe me as a risk taker.
Definitely. Yeah. So when did you start getting patients?
Okay. All right. Okay. After arriving in Paris. And that would have been the end, I would say the end of September, first part of October of
44. Okay.
We were then given our supplies and received orders to move up towards the front. Now, keep in mind that this forward movement changes, because we would be picking up patients from wherever they could get an ambulance into a train area and where we could meet up. Mm-hmm. Because the patients would come from field and evacuation hospitals by ambulance to the train station. And then we're loaded onto the train, is the way that procedure went. So train consisted of 8 boxcars, mm-hmm, with 3 tiers for stretchers. Oh, I have to show you a picture of that. Okay, there is a hospital train. There's our hospital train. You're going to see 21 on there. Now, our mailing address was 26th hospital train, but the British number on this train was 21. So we had a dual identification. Now there's a window of the hospital train. Mm-hmm. So you see, it's a regular. They used to describe them as 40 and 8 boxcars. Mm-hmm. Now this would be more the dining car, I would think. Then back in here, when you got where you carried the patients, I don't think there were any windows in that car, in our boxcars.
Is this the only window part? Is this darkened in then? Or is this the whole window?
This is a window right there. These are darkened.
Okay.
These are darkened. Yeah, that's a window right there. And see, these are, a lot of these are darkened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So how did you do things in the dark? Like, how did that
work?
Well,
but the lights were on inside.
Okay.
The lights were on. See, there were, that's a blackout.
Okay.
A blackout. They had regular panels mm-hmm. that we could stick on the window from the inside. Yeah. So that was in the personnel cars and in the dining area. And we also had with the, we had 8 boxcars.
Mm-hmm.
And in the middle of each boxcar was a sink. And on the opposite side was a chemical toilet. You know, as you see a freight train even going. Now, if you see an enclosed freight car going down the way, made out of wood, that really was what our box cars were like
mm-hmm.
for transportation of patients.
Mm-hmm.
And we had 8 of those box cars. We could transport 240 litter patients.
What's that mean?
Stretcher patients.
Okay.
They were, the least severe were put on the top bracket.
Okay.
And then right down the line. The most severe injured were on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
When they came to us from the ambulance, they were on a canvas stretcher, the old style stretcher. Do you have any vision of that type of thing?
Mm-hmm.
It's, all right. There is a, you'd have a man on one end and a man on the other.
Mm-hmm.
And the patient stayed on that stretcher all the time in that train. They were moved right onto that train. And we also had an ambulatory car which held 64 patients. And this was like the, well, like a regular old dining car with, you know, they could sit there and play cards where they could also eat and mm-hmm. so on. Totally, we could transport 304 patients per trip. We had, besides our living quarters for all personnel, a kitchen and a dining car, a pharmacy and surgical car, and a maintenance car. And there was even room for a padded cell, which was used occasionally, because we would have been transporting a mental patient.
Hmm.
Now, patients were transported from forward field and evacuation hospitals via ambulance to the railhead, where they were loaded onto the train. And I've described to you about the severely injured were placed on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. And we transported. Patients were then transported via the train to Rear General Hospitals, which would have been in the Paris area, or they may have been taken to the ships to be transported to England or even to the United States. Because we made some trips with patients from taking them directly to Cherbourg. And then they were placed on a hospital ship. Doctors would check the patient and write orders. The patients in need of antibodies would have a letter on their forehead, P for penicillin, or S for sulfa. Those are the only 2 antibiotics that we had.
Mm-hmm.
And each RN was assigned 2 cars. That meant 60 patients we were responsible for.
For 2 people, for 60 patients?
No, 2 cars.
2 cars.
2 cars, 60 patients. But there was 1 RN. Now, this is a normal type of thing. Now, keep in mind, we had medical aid men who were trained to work with injured, sick patients. So they did a lot of the work.
Mm-hmm.
Each corpsman two to three provided extra help. Patients were usually on the train for 24 to 36 hours. The supportive care given by medical personnel included changing dressings, giving medication, and food. Since this penicillin was first discovered, the process of giving it is much different than you would have any vision of. The medication came in vials in powder form and had to be mixed with sterile water. Mm-hmm. And injections were given every 3 to 4 hours. And the medical aid men were the penicillin team. Going from patient to patient and then starting over. Nurses carried 30 cc vials of morphine in their pockets. Syringes and needles were in each car, and this was given for pain. Sodium amytal, and that was a sleeping medication, and the GIs called that Blue 88s, were given for sleep. Patients were fed 3 meals a day, the same menu each run. And this is the menu. For breakfast, they had powdered scrambled eggs, bread, butter, and coffee. Peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, fruit cocktail, and coffee for lunch. Canned chicken a la King, bread, butter, more fruit, and coffee for supper. The soldiers loved this food, much better than sea rations. We had to eat the same food when we had patients aboard. Mm-hmm. And by the time my tour of duty was over, none of it tasted very good. So that kind of explains duties on the train.
Mm-hmm. What was it like? I mean, how did... Was it just constant? Was it...
It was pretty busy. Mm-hmm. I just want to interject something here because I feel it's important. Mm-hmm. I'm amazed at the resilience of the American soldier. It was always my impression that as a nurse serving in my capacity, we needed first to be a good listener. The soldier wanted to talk, to share their experiences, their memories of home, their fears, and their hopes for the future. Can you imagine in today's world someone saying a swear word as they were being transported into the train and a buddy saying, "Watch your language, soldier. There's an American nurse here." Can you imagine that? No, you can't. Most of our trips were scheduled in Belgium and France initially. But before the entire tour was over, we had evacuated patients from all four armies. Now, the 1st and the 9th Army were under Bradley and Montgomery. And they were located in the north. Patton's 3rd Army was located centrally, and the 7th Army under Hodge was in the southeastern part of France. This gave us an opportunity to see much of France, Belgium, Luxembourg, Holland, and Western Germany.
So that must have been very exciting.
It was very interesting, because while as we came from the forward areas back to wherever we were going, of course we were busy. As we went back up, that was our time for sitting there playing cards and relaxing and that type of thing. From September, do you want some statistics or no?
If you want.
Well, this is just from September 30th of 1944 to January 1st of 1945, the hospital train traveled approximately 20,000 miles, evacuating more than 9,000 patients. So this gives you an idea of the scope of some of our activities.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question. Were the trains segregated, or did you work with black women, black men, other minorities?
At that point in time, the military was still segregated.
Okay.
I don't remember ever seeing any black nurses over there. And as I have read the story of black nurses and have met one of them, and I think maybe she talked to this group, a group here on Sunday.
Prudence.
Right. That they, as I recall, she said that they were only, initially could take care of black soldiers and German prisoners. Hmm. I can't recall that there was any demarcation there. I'm more inclined to think that we transported people of color. I know we transported people from Senator Inouye's division. Mm-hmm. They were Japanese Americans, and I know we transported some of them. So I'm sure that we likely transported some injured black soldiers also. But as far as black nurses, I do not recall interacting at all with any black nurses.
And did you evac then the white and the black soldiers together? Or?
Yeah, yes, definitely.
Okay. Good.
I don't recall that there was any demarcation there at all.
Okay.
Because the one thing I do recall as we were, and I don't know when this happened, as we were getting to England, and we had enlisted personnel and personnel from throughout the United States, and I remember hearing said that you have to leave your colored biases behind. So, because as I think about working at a hospital in England prior to going on the train, we had people of color at that hospital. We mm-hmm. had people from Northern Africa. We had people from many different cultures.
England seems more integrated than America.
At that point in time, because in all probabilities, their closeness to other continents where there's people of other cultures.
Did you ever feel like you were in danger?
Yes, only one time. Okay. Okay, we were, have you ever heard of buzz bombs?
Mm-mm.
Okay. This was in 1945, and we were making trips from Paris up to Liège and Vivieres, Belgium. Now, Vivieres was much closer to Aachen, Germany. At that point in time, the Germans were firing buzz bombs into England and also into Belgium. Now, a buzz bomb, you'd hear this, it was like a putt-putt motor. That's all I can think of, you know, something you hear up in the sky that, well, is it going to keep going or isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Once you didn't hear that motor anymore, it was going to be coming straight down. It was a bomb. And once the noise stopped, the bomb would head straight down. And this was the same type of bombs that Germany used on the large cities of England for months prior to D-Day.
Mm-hmm.
Until Antwerp was recaptured, death and destruction continued in Britain. Now, where was it that I'm going to describe? We were It was at the time of the Battle of the Bulge. And we were in Liège, Belgium, and we were in a rail yard. And at that point in time, I remember hearing these buzz bombs coming in all night long. And one of them crashed close to where our train was. And I remember the broken windows and looking out and seeing some fire and so on. And we were evacuated from the train very rapidly. Mm-hmm. We had no patients on at that point in time, and they got us to an air raid shelter. And I was very scared at that point in time, but that's the one time, the one time. Yeah. And the end of that story is when daylight came, and they took a look to see what damage had been done. And before we left that location, Liège, Belgium, patients were loaded onto our car, onto our box cars, and we took the patients back to rear hospitals. The damage was done to the personnel car, mm-hmm. and the dining car where the windows were and the boarded up windows were. So that was the one scary time.
We have your uniform that we're going to use for the exhibit. Is that what you wore?
Oh, you mean the striped one,
yeah.
Brown and white striped one. We wore those in summertime.
Okay.
In the wintertime, oh, it was so cold. Oh, those boxcars were terrible. In the wintertime, we wore wool slacks and combat boots and a wool shirt, a wool regular army shirt, and as many clothes as you could stick on underneath to keep yourself warm. I think we had long underwear on. When I talk about how cold it was, each GI or each patient, we only had two blankets for each patient. Now, that isn't many blankets when the train isn't very warm, because there's only one, those boxcars are heated by steam heat. And often when we had to use adhesive tape, we would have to put the tape on the steam pipes in order to get some, so you could, it would stick to a patient.
Mm-hmm.
See, it made it more gooey. Again, I go back to how cold it was.
So there wasn't very much emphasis on looking ladylike?
Oh, heavenly days, no. Oh, no. You had a GI jacket, an overcoat. Have I got one here? I haven't got one. Well, here we are.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are, right there. That was common attire for us,
mm-hmm.
As we worked and as we were in forward areas. We always had a helmet on our heads.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we were working on the train, we didn't. But as we went outside, the helmet went right along with us, and that's what we had to wear. But you see, here we didn't have very fancy clothes. There's the slacks.
Mm-hmm.
There's the slacks, so and the boots, the combat boots, they were not made for women, and they came out to about mid-calf,
mm-hmm.
and they were made for men, so you always, in order to get a size that would fit you, you had to, look for the small size. And a lot of our uniforms initially were soldiers' jackets or whatever. In small size. Yeah.
What was your experience when transporting the men with them, experiencing their story? What was that like?
Oh, you just had to stand there and listen. Because a lot of them, they'd say it was bothering them. I was in a foxhole with to my buddies. And artillery came over, and one of them was badly injured, one of them was killed, and I'm not badly injured at all. How come? Or two people were killed. How come? I'm just got slightly injured. That seemed to bother them a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think that's understandable. You would tend to think, how come?
So your role as nurse went far beyond just nursing?
Oh, yes. It went every direction. It went every direction. But I always maintain you had to be the good listener. Because you'd stand around and here's one nurse and here's a bunch of GIs just talking. And likely you didn't have to say very much. Just listen. You were part of the listening group. Because they wanted to talk. They talked. I think they came home and never said another word. Because that's the one thing that you read about in today, that families didn't know what their father or their grandfather had to go through. They had no idea. And it's kind of sad, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it really is. I have encouraged people to write their story,
mm-hmm.
to write it for their children, their grandchildren. And one of my friends who's now in Florida, I said, write your story, because he'd been in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I tried, and all I could do was cry. And I said, well, try again. It gets easier. And I think to tell your story, it's sad, but it gets easier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it is a story that needs to be told, because my generation gave an awful lot. And if you haven't read Tom Brokaw's books, those are pretty good.
I got one for my dad.
Oh, did you really? Yeah. Because my grandchildren, periodically I'll send them something about what life was like way back when.
Mm-hmm.
And they enjoy that. And I'm sure they're collecting it. So, during this time, on this train, we transported over 17,000 patients.
Wow.
And we had only one patient die en route.
That's amazing.
Isn't that amazing? To me, it's a tribute to the good triage that the medical corps did of patients, but also a good coordination with the Army transport, the railroad system, in if we had a patient that developed trouble en route, then that patient would be identified as somebody that needed to be taken to a hospital as we were headed back to our destination. And so that very thing would happen. We would stop off and there would be an ambulance there. So that patient would be taken to a hospital.
You said you had a surgical car,
yes. If emergency surgery had to be done. But that particular thing never happened.
Really?
No, it never happened. But keep in mind again the 24 to 36 hours that they would have been on the train,
mm-hmm.
and they had already gone through the triage in a field or a VAC hospital, And so they had been well triaged. Mm-hmm. And these are young patients. Mm-hmm. So I think that that concept was extremely good. And the reason that hospital trains were used during my period of time that I'm describing was the supplies were so badly needed in forward areas, and the trucks could not keep up with the supply and demand. Mm-hmm. So a lot of supplies were moved by airplane. And airplane evacuation did not come into play during that period of time that I'm describing. That's why hospital trains were utilized so much. At one time, there were 55 hospital trains on the continent. Years later, and I never knew this until I went back in 95 and did the beaches, and it was with a group of people, veterans. Mm-hmm. And some of them, one of the men had been an ambulance driver. And he told the story about they would pick up patients by ambulance and take them to airplanes. And I never realized that there was any airplane evacuation at that point in time, but they could likely do that better than this more larger vehicle of mm-hmm. getting in those areas. Mm-hmm. And they had to get them away from certain areas. So it depended on what was going on and how congested and the needs at that point in time of the armies. Interesting, isn't it?
How did it feel working for something that was so completely necessary, so...
I felt like I was doing my duty. Mm-hmm. And I had a skill, and I was helping. I think once you're a nurse, you're always a nurse. Mm-hmm. It was a helping profession. We were needed, and we were there. Yep. We were needed, and we were there.
How do you feel about your experience overall, and would you serve again?
Oh, hey. Hey, I'd forgotten all the bad things. I only remember the good things. I would encourage anybody, male or female, to do something for their country. Because if we don't do anything for our country, we won't have it. Mm-hmm. We will not have it. And I have always felt very kindly towards the military. I got a host of experience. And this provided me with a real good background to do what I next did mm-hmm. in my career. So, because I worked over here with General Motors for 37 years in the medical department. And my background in the military was a tremendous background to then work in occupational health nursing. It really was. It was a great experience. I wouldn't take any amount of money for it. I often wonder sometimes why I didn't stay in, but a lot of my friends did. But at that point in time, my decision was to get out. And I think it was the right decision. Yeah.
Are you glad you also, that you went overseas?
Oh, yes. Oh, heavens, yes. Oh, and I've been back. On quite a few occasions mm-hmm. to various areas of the overseas, you know, not just to look at what and where and why, but to other areas of Germany and other areas of the European continent. Oh, yes. I love traveling.
What do you think of the future of women in the military, women in combat and war in general? What do you do?
I think, and I've heard some young women that are flying helicopters right now.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been well trained. And that's what I have to feel, that some form of service for your country.
Mm-hmm.
And these young ladies that are serving in the combat areas on ships and so on, a lot of them have the officers I know have come up through ROTC programs or through the Naval Academy or some other college experience. And the enlisted personnel have, I don't think that by and large many of them would react negatively to their experience. The enlisted personnel have done a tremendous job.
Mm-hmm.
They know they have a job to do and they do it very well. And we should be very proud of them. We should be very proud. Who knows what's going to happen in the future? I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
I think America was very amazed what happened September 11th. But also, way back when, December 7th, 1941, we were aghast that so much damage could be done.
Mm-hmm.
So fast. So, who knows? Who knows? I think that the trend has been more towards, I'm trying to think of the word, and I'm going to stall a minute here until I think of it. Maybe I won't. Well, good communications. We've got good people in our government. We've mm-hmm. got good people in our executive branch. And they're not blind to what's going on in the world. I have to feel that our form of government is the best form of government going.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like with everything else, there can always be downfalls. But since I have had the opportunity to travel all those various places, and I've traveled in a lot of communistic countries, I still feel we've got the best of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
We have. We absolutely have. Whether or not the rest of the world will ever get caught up to us, I don't know. So.
Well, thank you.
Well, you're welcome.